Hi, everyone, and welcome to Malice in the Mitten. I am your host, Tracy Preston, and with my bestie, Christine. Hey, Christine.
Hi, Tracy. You get ready to talk about some stuff that probably shouldn't even be thought about, but we're into it.
Yes, I'm totally ready. I'm very excited. This is season one, episode one. This is a heavy hitter. It's pretty horrific. It has to do with children. So if anybody is triggered by crimes against children, this might not be the episode for you. So let's get into this doozy of a story. All right, here we go. So this is a story of the Oakland County child killer, also known as the babysitter killer. These murders occurred in Oakland County, Michigan. Four children were abducted, missing for days, then were all found at separate times, lying in snowbanks where they would easily be seen. The youngest of the four was 10 years old. The others were 11 and 12, two boys and two girls. These events took place between February 15, 1976 through March 16, 1977. If you're wondering why these killings were dubbed the babysitter killer, it's because each child, while in captivity, had been cared for, meaning they were fed, their hair was combed, their fingernails and toenails clipped, and their clothes had been washed and ironed before they were deposited outside in the snowbanks, along roads and behind local stores to be discovered. To this day, there's never been a single conviction, which is heartbreaking. Oakland County is a suburb of Detroit. In the 1970s, it was known that there was a child pedophile ring in this area, which included extremely wealthy, powerful men in and around Michigan. I read a great article by J. Reuben Appleman, which then led me to a series on Hulu called Children of the Snow, which was originally aired on Investigation ID back in 2019. All of the articles that I read, I found Appleman's article and documentary to be the most detailed and comprehensive. So I've chosen these as my main sources for the episode. You see, Jay Appleman, who I will now refer to as Jason, like the other children in the story, grew up in Oakland County. Jason narrowly escaped an abduction himself when the killings were happening. He was just 7 years old at the time. He would have been among the youngest to be murdered. Luckily for Jason, he turned and ran. He was the lucky one. But these horrific murders plagued him. You see, after Jason became a grown man, married with children of his own, he couldn't stop thinking of the unsolved murders and was determined to do what the police failed to, and that was to solve the Oakland County child killer cases.
The thing is when he was a kid, like, I don't know, I didn't see the show, I didn't do all this research that you did to tell this story, so, which is my part of this gig, right? So I don't understand. Did he like reach out to the cops? Did his parents reach out to the cops when he was almost abducted and they didn't do anything about it?
I didn't see anything that I read that he or his parents had done that. I don't know. I mean, a lot of these kids that were, you know, you'll see as we get into the story, there's some deeper stuff going on here with a pedophile ring. But yeah, a lot of the boys that were taken there and molested by these men, they never even said anything to their parents. Which is crazy.
Yeah.
Absolutely crazy. So,
okay, go ahead. Keep going.
Okay. So Jason began his investigation in 2005 and dedicated the next 13 years researching with some of the family members of the murdered children. Jason had connected with Catherine Broad, who was Timothy King's sister, the last of the four children that were abducted and murdered. Catherine had also dedicated her life to solving her brother's murder. She had obtained a mountain of legal documents and handed Jason all she had in hopes that he would be able to make some progress. It sounds like she had run into many stumbling blocks and told Jason that he has to be careful with who he talks to because she 100% believed that a cover-up had been and was still in full swing. And guess what? She was right. Jason did find...
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, right. What's new, right? Jason did find that the police had sat on primary suspects, but there was one detective he found he could trust, and that was Detective Corey Williams. At the time of the documentary had been filmed and debuted in 2019, Detective Corey Williams was the longest standing detective on the case. So let's talk about that first victim. His name was Mark Stebbins. In 1976, Mark was only 12 years old. He lived in Ferndale, a part of the Detroit metropolitan area. His mother was working at the American Legion, which was only a handful of blocks from their home. Mark was there with her, but he wanted to walk home and watch a war movie that would be on TV soon. You see, Mark loved anything that had to do with the military, and when he grew up, he wanted to be a Marine. The date was February 15th, 1976. It was a sunny afternoon, which in Michigan, at that time of year, is not very common. Mark's mother finally gave in and allowed him to walk home. Sometime later, Mark's brother arrived, but Mark wasn't there. At 11 p.m. on February 15th, Mark's mother called the police and reported him missing. He was wearing a blue hooded parka, blue jeans, a red sweatshirt, and black rubber boots. He was just 4 feet 8 inches tall with reddish blonde hair and blue eyes.
I can't even take this. Like just for a minute, what would that be like to know that you told him no a million times? You know, because he's a kid and he's asking his mom to walk home. So you could just imagine, right?
Yes.
Beating him. But here he is, 12-year-old kid, and he's probably annoying his mom while she's at work. And then finally she relents, and then her son goes missing. Do you know how hard she beat herself up for how she should have just listened to herself?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That poor woman, like, just for a minute, besides what you're going to talk about and what you're going to tell us about what eventually happened, just in that moment,
yeah,
the next couple of hours, I'm sure, when the police were there and asking them all the details that you just gave us, like, what was he wearing? What did he look like? How, you know, how tall was he? All that angst that this mother experienced just in those few hours, never mind everything else we're going to know about, right?
Absolutely.
It's just crazy to me.
It just makes me completely ill. I mean, you and I both have kids. I have a 12-year-old daughter right now. No, I just couldn't. I don't even know how I could go on, to be honest.
Yeah, like, talk about the self-abuse that you're going to be doing for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
Over something that, of course, who would blame her? Yeah, she let her kid finally walk home. She was a few blocks.
Right.
You know, on any other given day, it would have been totally fine.
Yeah.
But just because some evil was lurking, he never comes home again. It's just hard to think about.
It is. It's absolutely just horrible. So let's talk about what happened. So Mark's body was found 4 days later, not far from his home at all, on February 19th. His body was neatly laid in a snowbank in the back parking lot of an office building on 10 Mile Road in Southfield, which is a suburb just north of Detroit. So not far at all, just north from where he lived. His autopsy noticed the cause of death was asphyxia caused by smothering. He had two small lacerations on the back of his head, discoloration on his wrists and ankles, and his anus was distended with lacerations, which are deep cuts or tears. He was fully clothed in the outfit his mother reported him wearing when he left the American Legion. The second victim was 12-year-old Jill Robinson. Jill lived in Royal Oak, also a suburb of Detroit in Oakland County, which is located just north of Ferndale, where Mark Stebbins lived. It was Wednesday, December 22nd, 1976. It was almost dinner time, and Carol, Jill's mother, was frustrated with her daughter because Jill was refusing to help her mother with dinner preparations, you know, getting food on the table. But Jill dug in her heels and absolutely refused to help. If you have a 12-year-old daughter like I do, you know this struggle, and it's real. Personally, I get it. You can only take it so much before you've finally had enough, just like Jill's mother did. Finally, Carol said, quote, "Just put your coat on, go outside, and stand in the yard. If you don't want to be here, come back in after you've thought about it," end quote. Now, let's keep in mind that it's December and super cold outside. I looked up what the weather was on this day in history, and on December 22nd, 1976, it was 29 degrees and 16 mile per hour winds. Let me tell you, that's cold and you don't want to be out there for long. I imagine that is what Jill's mother was thinking as well. I know I would have. But you have to remember, she's dealing with a preteen. At this age, they think they know everything and can be extremely headstrong and determined. Well, I imagine that Jill probably didn't have to think about it too long. Her father lived only a few miles away in Birmingham. Jill went back in the house, packed a few items in her backpack, grabbed her bike, and off she pedaled, presumably to her dad's. Now, I'm not clear on who called who. Perhaps Carol called her ex-husband to let him know what happened and to probably expect to see their daughter sometime soon. But as midnight approached, if Jill was going to her father's, she never made it there. Her father called the police to report her missing, and according to the documentary, a friend of the family had even reported seeing Jill riding her bike. The day after her disappearance, Jill's bike had been found behind a hobby store on North Main Street in Royal Oak. Her body was found 4 days later, the day after Christmas, on December 26, alongside Interstate 75 in Troy. She was fully clothed, still wearing her backpack, lying on a snowbank. There was a witness that reported seeing a blue Pontiac Le Mans stopped along the highway where Jill was found. As the witness drew closer, the car moved forward like it was leaving, but they noticed as they were passing that the car stopped again. The witness's statement was found to be credible, but for one reason or another, that lead was never investigated. The police didn't feel that Jill was connected initially to the Oakland County killings. Per Catherine's blog, again, this is Tim King's sister, he's the last of the four that was abducted and murdered. She has a blog, and the police report that she has there describes Jill's autopsy findings that the cause of death was due to a shotgun wound that, quote,
blew the top of her head off with a 12-gauge shotgun.
Jill was not sexually assaulted, but she was shot at close range where her body was found due to all the blood at the scene. It is also believed that, like Mark, she was asphyxiated. So there was a pattern with asphyxiation like Mark, but the little girl was shot and Mark was not. So why? Christine, you and I both know, as we have had many patients pass on our shift, while we were preparing the body for the family to say their goodbyes, that trapped air sometimes escapes and you hear that guttural moan. You've heard that, right?
Yeah.
It's quite possible that Jill had trapped air in her lungs as well. And when her body hit the hard snow, the trapped air escaped. And they heard that sound that is so familiar to us. This could have made the killer or killers think that she was still alive. So maybe that's why they shot her, you know, just to make sure that she was really gone. But just like Mark, Jill had been fed and her clothes had been washed.
Yeah, but do we really, like, I don't know. We didn't get that deep into the story yet. But just like my first knee-jerk instinct on all the things we know nowadays about psychopaths and the many reasons why they do what they did, you know, that's why we're so into this crime stuff, right? Is why do they do the things they do?
Right.
I mean, it really could have been anything. Like, of course, the young boy was sexually assaulted and not shot, but he was asphyxiated. This little girl was asphyxiated and shot, but not sexually assaulted. So were these psychopaths just pedophiles with a penchant for little boys and the malice in their heart to just murder? You know what I mean? So it's like almost they were trying different ways. It just doesn't sit with me well. Like, it automatically makes me think of these psychopaths just like really fully enjoyed harming the kids, you know, like in multiple fashions. I'll stop there with that.
Yeah. And you know what? I got to say, I agree, because with the two girls, I can't wrap my head around that either. I mean, these men were into little boys and they wanted to have sex with little boys. So I don't know if they were crafting their craft, so to speak, right? Like, okay, let's get them and do these things and get better at it. And then I think maybe just the opportunity presented itself. I really don't know. I mean, I do struggle with why the girls were taken as well.
Why any of them were taken, of course, we're going to struggle with. But yeah, to me so far, and the little that I know about this story, I didn't do the research you did. So we have the crust of it. And it seems like they literally just took the girls to torture.
Yeah.
Like that was their only purpose.
It does.
And I know that sounds totally sick that we can have that conversation and be like, oh, well, their purpose was pedophilia and their purpose was sexual assault, which that in and of itself is an absurd thing that we can even speak so easily about. You know what I mean? Like, it's an absurd concept, but we're almost used to it because it happens so frequently.
Yeah.
And in my personal opinion, we still don't do enough to stop. And what this story is going to bring us down is the financial abilities, which is why maybe there was no convictions, but I'm getting ahead of ourselves again, so I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. No, all good conversation. So let's talk about that third victim. The third victim was Christy Mialik. She was the youngest of the victims at only 10 years old. According to Bean.com, quote, Christine lived with her mother in Berkeley and was in fifth grade. She was last seen on January 2nd, 1977. She had asked her mom if she could walk to 7-Eleven to buy a teen magazine. Remember Teen Beats and all that when we were kids? We had to have them, right? It was only a handful of blocks away. And at first, her mom said no because she was worried about her crossing the heavily congested traffic streets. I would think also that the temperature would have been a factor, but hey, it's winter in Michigan, you know, we're used to it.
You Michiganians are used to that cold.
We sure are. If Christine is anything like my daughter, I imagine that she wouldn't stop asking over and over and over until her mom just finally caved in and agreed to let her go. The police know that Christine made it to the store, as a clerk remembered seeing her and selling her the magazine. But, like the others, she never made it home. January 21st, 1977, 19 days after she disappeared, 19 days they had this girl. Quote, a mail carrier delivering mail on Bruce Lane in Franklin Village saw something in the snow at the end of the cul-de-sac that caught his attention. As he got closer, he saw a small hand protruding out of the snow. Christine's autopsy revealed the cause of death to be asphyxia from smothering. So we have a pattern for sure. In the report, it was noted that her body was not completely frozen, so I wondered, how long does it actually take for her body to freeze? When I looked it up on Bean.com, I found that, quote, the time it takes a corpse to freeze depends on many factors, including ambient temperature and humidity, If the temperature is below freezing, the body will freeze more quickly, which totally makes sense. The rate can vary depending on the size of the body, the clothing worn, and the presence of any insulating materials. Freezing can cause damage to the body's tissues and make it more difficult to determine the cause of death. And additionally, freezing can alter the rate of decomposition, which can impact the accuracy of the time of death. I looked into the weather on January 21st on almanac.com and found that the low was 19.9 degrees with a high of 26.2 degrees. That is absolutely below freezing. With Jill being just a little girl, you can only assume that she was not in the snow for very long. As in Jill's case, Christine had not been sexually assaulted. The physician who performed the autopsy commented that, quote,
"She must have dressed herself, and that all of her clothes, including her underwear, were clean after being missing for 19 days.
Christine's mother said that, quote, "The way Christine's shirt was tied and the way her pants were tucked into her boots was something she never did."
Yeah, which gives you the impression that they treated them like a little bit like dolls. Mm. And this is a time before they had like DNA evidence and stuff. So psychopaths nowadays, they're armed with all the information that the rest of us have, right?
Right.
So cleaning their clothes and laundering their clothes and clipping their nails and all of these things that these babysitter killer did, right? That, like, my mind automatically wants to go to, oh, because they were trying to keep it clean, so it was less likely for them to be caught, right? DNA evidence stuff.
Right.
But back in the 70s, that wasn't a thing.
It wasn't.
What kind of psychosis are we dealing with just the baby doll kind of role play that's happening here? It's kind of a little bit crazy. Like, of course, all of this is crazy, but that's like, it makes you dive a little deeper into the psyche of these people. I want to say they're people.
Me too.
Just based on the little that I know. I don't think this is a one-person deal. So I don't know why they call it the babysitter killer.
Agreed.
But then again, you know, nobody ever looked into that one car and the one guy that was in the one car. So,
right.
I don't know.
Right.
Maybe it was just one guy. I mean, what is it? Ted Bundy and the other guys, they did it by themselves too when it seemed like there was a lot to do.
Right.
I mean, these psychopaths are really, they're organized.
Right.
They put a lot into it.
Exactly. Exactly. And I think that we're not dealing with just some sloppy, you know, low level intelligence person. I think we're dealing with some very intelligent people that were a little bit ahead of their time with being careful about washing the clothes, not to leave any DNA, dropping them off in the snow, that whole thing. Definitely a higher level functioning person. Yeah. So according to the article written by Jason Appleman, quote, "Bruce Lane is named after a prominent psychiatrist named Bruce Danto. Bruce was an author and authored books on serial killers in the early 70s. So who's to say they weren't reading these books, right?
Yeah. Copycat killers. I mean, I feel like we have a lot of them out there, unfortunately.
Yeah.
So this psychopath or these psychopaths could have been, you know, taking a page out of the book, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe they were one of the patients of the prominent psychiatrist. I don't know. Who's to say?
That's a good take on it for sure. I'm liking where you're going here. It makes sense, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So there had been some chatter that the killer or killers were posing a challenge to this man. So there you go. And perhaps the authorities as well, because if you didn't know where Bruce Lane was located, you wouldn't find it too easily. So the fourth and last victim was a young boy named Timothy King. He was 11 years old. His parents and siblings were headed out for a bit, and Tim would be hanging back at the house. I'm not sure why, but hey, the doors were locked and the family was returning in just a little bit, so I don't think it was that uncommon for parents to, you know, allow their 11-year-old to stay home for a short little bit while they ran out. Especially in the 70s, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I think
we were all latchkey kids back then.
Yeah, for sure. I was. So Tim had borrowed some money from his sister so he could walk to the store, which I'm assuming was not far from the home, so he could buy some candy. So innocent. He asked his sister to just, you know, leave the door unlocked and just keep it open a smidge so he could get back in because nobody else was going to be home when he got back. But on Wednesday, March 16th, 1977, Tim grabbed his skateboard close to 8 p.m. and left the house. When Tim's parents arrived back home around 9, they found the door still cracked open, but Tim was nowhere to be seen. A clerk at the drugstore remembered seeing Timothy buy candy. Quote, "A woman reported around 8:30 on March 16th, 1977, that she saw a small boy with a red jacket speaking to a man in the parking lot as she was loading her groceries in her car. She even provided a sketch of the man she saw to the police. She was also able to describe the color and description of the vehicle, which was, quote,
a dark blue gremlin with a white, upswept stripe along its side.
Remember those things? They were about the ugliest vehicles ever. 6 days after Timothy went missing at 11:15 p.m. on March 22, 1977, he was found in Livonia, lying in a ditch. The description was, quote,
a small boy wearing a red nylon jacket, denim shirt, green trousers, and white tennis shoes with blue and red stripes on them.
So exactly what this woman reported in the parking lot. Timothy's autopsy showed his death, as in the others, to be from asphyxiation by means of, quote, smothered at the time of death is estimate at 68 hours upon being found. He had eaten a meal of fowl about an hour before he was killed. His wrists, just like Mark, show that he may have been bound. Quote,
the body was very clean, including fingernails and toenails. They had been clipped and scraped clean. He had been sexually assaulted, the anal region showing obvious signs of some form of abuse.
Prior to the discovery of Tim's body, his parents had been on the news pleading to whomever had their son. During a news conference, his mother had said, if you please come home, I will get you your favorite dinner, Kentucky Fried Chicken. So hearing that, do you think it was possible that Tim's abductors watched the news and made sure that they gave him his favorite last meal? I just find this absolutely disgusting. Like they're doing him a favor.
And the thing my brain goes to is, did Tim see that news? Did he see his parents on the news crying for his safety and crying for him to come home?
God.
Like, that's just another whole layer of trauma. You know what I mean?
I do.
For this poor kid. Oh, God. This stuff is horrible.
Investigating officers noted similarities with all four children. Quote, these crimes support the theory that they were interrelated, that is, committed by a single killer or small group of killers. And per Catherine's blog, she elicited what was in the police reports that she received.
All victims were alone when abducted. Also, they were taken from business areas or in parking lots. Two victims were abducted on a Sunday afternoon and two on a Wednesday evening. Victims appear to have been well-fed and not subjected to weather or other exposure. The victims were well cared for during their period of captivity, including caring for their normal biological needs. All the bodies were clean, and Tim's body was described as clinically clean with some kind of medical cleaning agent. His fingers and toenails had been cut and scraped clean. All four victims were dressed in their own clothing, possibly by someone else, just before or after their deaths. Victims were held captive for periods ranging from 3 days to 19 days. All four bodies were deposited along roadsides where they would readily be found. There was no evidence of sexual molestation of either girl. Both boys showed obvious anal dilatation. Little if any force was used in the abductions. No commotions were reported.
The Flint police notified the Southfield police that they had a person of interest in custody. That person was a 27-year-old Gregory Woodard Green, born in Detroit in 1950 and eventually, quote, died in prison of a heart attack while watching TV in December of 1995. It took a while for inmates and guards to realize that he had died, as his eyes were open and it looked as though he was still watching TV. Green was in California in late 1969 to 1970. And per Catherine's blog on Gregory Green, quote, Green admitted criminal sexual conduct while in California that involved some 50 victims and damn near murdered a young boy after raping him. While in California, Green was charged with felony child molesting, sodomy, and sex perversion. The program director at the state hospital said that, quote, Green is a young man of above average intelligence. He has no emotional desire to change his past behavior, except that he had been incarcerated and confined to state institutions for his behavior. Due to Mr. Green's repeated offenses regarding homosexual pedophilia, it is recommended that he be committed to a state institution for long-term psychiatric treatment. Because of Mr. Green's above-average intelligence, he is capable of, quote, putting on a show and making others believe he has changed when he really has not. Green was back in Michigan just before Mark Stebbins was abducted. In 1977, Green, while in custody in Flint for criminal sexual conduct, flipped on his friend, Christopher Bush, for killing Mark Stebbins in February 1976. Green told police that both he and Christopher talked about their fantasies of kidnapping a boy. They would find, capture, and, quote, forcefully molest them.
So, wait a minute. What am I missing? Who's Christopher?
Christopher is a new name that just popped up. So Christopher and this Green guy, they were buddies, and they loved to to molest children, and they would kind of, you know, hang out and talk about their fantasies of what they would do, how to kidnap a boy, what they would do when they have them, and that they would enjoy forcefully molesting these children when they had them. So Christopher's a new character, so we're going to talk about him a little bit more. Okay. So he was the son of a former top executive at General Motors. So this guy came from money.
Yeah. So did we ever know about the other one? He come from money?
Green did not.
Green didn't come from money.
No, he did not. But he was a friend of this guy, Chris, who did come from money. But they had that one thing in common about little boys. And I'm not sure exactly how they hooked up. There's some more stuff that I'm going to be talking about, which could possibly be how they came across each other.
Yeah, well, birds of a feather tend to flock together.
Yeah, they do. So listen to this. So Bush was a four-time convicted pedophile, of which he barely spent any time in jail because, you know, his family was powerful. They had influence and ability to post his bond every time he was in jail.
That's always the totally unfair thing about the American justice system is the more money you have, the easier it is for you to beat reps. Mm. It's crazy to me, but
it's
go on.
Completely unjust.
That's another topic.
Yeah. It is believed that Bush's father, Harold Lee Bush, had influence in the police department as well. So there you go. The police picked up Bush and escorted him home. And that's what's even crazier. They picked up this guy after Green had, you know, given them these details. But yet they escorted him home because he wanted to grab his toothbrush. And they did it.
Crazy.
Totally
bananas.
Totally bananas. So why in the hell? Why in the hell? Why in the hell would they ever do that? When police were in Bush's bedroom, they saw a rope, shotguns, and a suitcase full of pictures of child porn. Bush did tell the police that he was a pedophile, newsflash, and he was obsessed with little boys. Bush was given a polygraph, and guess what? He frickin' passed.
Of course, he's a psychopath. Of course they're going to pass a polygraph. That's why I really never understood polygraphs.
Yeah.
They're based on your heart rate. And a psychopath is not going to change his heart rate when he's talking about things.
Yeah, because they have zero empathy.
Stupid.
Zero.
Yeah. So dumb.
Yeah.
But go on.
So, you know, of course, after the polygraph, he passed all that. His family, again, posted bond and he was free to go. Even after fully admitting he loves boys, loves them, he's a pedophile. He has a history. Back in the 70s, you know.
And a polygraph. Back in the 70s.
Yeah.
Whatever. Right. Prove my butt. It's just, we were dumb. We were just dumb. We didn't know enough in the 70s. So dumb.
Yeah, exactly. They thought that was the end all be all, right? And guess who else passed their polygraph test? Mr. Green. But.
Of course.
Yeah. But he remained in custody because his family couldn't afford to post bond to get him out. There you go. So roughly 18 months after Timothy King's abduction, Bush, quote, committed suicide in August of 1978 in his large bedroom at his family's estate in Bloomfield Township. Now, Bloomfield.
I was just going to stop you right there because I'm hoping, like, I know this is horrible and it probably makes me just as bad as some of these people that we're going to be talking about, but there's like a little part of me that kind of hopes he didn't commit suicide. Somebody, a parent of one of these kids, caught up to him and murdered his ass. Like, that's just, that's going to be my little secret golden silver lining.
All right, well, hang on. Here we go. So if you look through the references for this podcast, you're going to see actual pictures of Bush laying in his bed, all wrapped up in his blankets. There's a shotgun in his hands off to the right of his body, the tip of the barrel pointing toward his face. But check this out. In the picture, you can see the headboard, the wall, the bedside table, the floor. Like, you can actually see quite a bit of this guy's bedroom. But here's what's interesting. There's not a single speck, not a single speck of blood to be seen anywhere. This guy supposedly blew his head off laying in bed.
Yeah, which is very, very messy.
Very messy.
I have not been there for the actual happenings, but I can tell you as a trauma ICU nurse, I am there right afterwards and it is a mess.
Yeah.
There is gray matter all over the place.
Yeah.
There is blood all over the place. Mm-hmm. It is the most profuse bleeding that you can even imagine. If you've ever seen any kind of blood, if you've ever seen anyone cut themselves or an accident and you think you've seen someone bleed, that is nothing like a head wound.
No.
Never mind a shotgun blast to the brain.
Exactly. So
I digress.
Yeah. So there's something sketchy, right? And also seen, posted on this man's wall, is a sketch. And it's quite horrifying. You'll also see it if you hit any of the links in the show notes. The sketch is said to resemble Timothy King, right?
Hmm.
Yeah, it's just absolutely crazy. There's also a rope on the bedroom floor, and it is noted that there is dark red material seen, such as blood on the rope. But when I was looking at the picture, I couldn't see that. I just couldn't. So, you know, is it possible that Bush's bedroom was staged to put all the blame on the Oakland County child killer on him? I read that Bush was involved in child pornography, and he had previously been convicted of forcing dozens of boys to perform oral sex on him. During Jason Appleman's research, he came across a known pedophile in the Detroit area named Richard Lawson. So we have another player here. While under arrest, Lawson said that he knew the people involved in the Michigan snow killings. In the 70s, Lawson was working with the police to identify potential suspects involved in the Oakland County child killings. When asked why he thought he could identify a suspect, he replied,
"Because I have no doubt in my mind that this person would come into the Detroit area, and the very first place he would go was the 6 Mile Woodward area."
He continues to say that he and other pedophiles would hang out in the Cass Corridor. Now, Cass Corridor is just extremely poverty-stricken, okay? It was a cesspool for drugs, hookers, bars, and chock full of poor kids in the streets. A man named Bob Moore, a.k.a. they called him Bad Eye Bob, due to his left eye being severely crossed, he looks crazy in the pictures. You should see him. Well, he owned a bike repair shop in the corridor. He, like Bush and Green, was obsessed with young boys and would photograph and film them. There were many parties thrown in abandoned buildings with these men that had a lot of money where they would swap children and photos of them as well. The boys on the streets of the corridor would be offered money, drugs, and alcohol to attend, but it came at a price. Bad Eye Bob knew plenty of high-paying men that would attend. As the police were starting to identify the pedophile rings, they came across a millionaire by the name Francis Sheldon. He owned North Fox Island, which was disguised as a retreat for boys. They had flyers, you name it, made it look like it was a great place for these kids to go. And it gave them the opportunity to get away, you know, like going to summer camp, which their parents could never afford. And I'm sure they're more than grateful for this opportunity that was presented to their kids. But a summer vacation it was not. It was an island of horrors and trauma for these boys. North Fox Island is located in Lake Michigan, approximately 17 miles northwest of Cathead Point, near the tip of Leelanau Peninsula. Leelanau Peninsula, just FYI, is a great place to go. It's like wine country. It's amazing. But that's where the tip of this peninsula, 17 miles, that's where this island was located. And it actually consisted of two islands, North Fox and South Fox Island. And it was huge. It was approximately 820 acres of uninhabited land.
And like secluding them for sure.
Yeah, right.
Jesus.
Yeah, how about that? Where you can't get there unless you have a boat or a plane. Sheldon would fly these boys to the island, promising them and their parents an amazing getaway on the island for what turned out to be weeks at a time. The boys would have the ability to hike, swim, and enjoy all the island had to offer. This was an island where wealthy men would fly in, photograph, and molest and film the molestation to fulfill their horrid and forbidden fantasies. The island was a safe harbor for them to live out their every fantasy, but for the boys that were there, it was a total nightmare. Per the documentary, Bad Eye Bob would give the films he made on the island to Francis Sheldon. So remember, he's the guy that owned the island and would recruit all these boys and would fly them in. And he would, in turn, distribute the films and the photographs and sell them overseas in Amsterdam. It's crazy. Another name of interest was Gerald Richards. Wait till you hear this. He was married with children and also a gym teacher at a Catholic school in Port Huron. He also had a side gig of working children's birthday parties as a clown performing magic tricks. Who does that remind you of? John Wayne Gacy, right?
Yeah.
Yep. So that's what this guy used to do. Now, listen to this. So Richards met a boy by the name of Michael Farquhar. He was 12 years old in 1975. The two of them met when Farquhar was trying to, you know, make some money by shoveling snow. It's a pretty common thing around here.
Yeah.
It wasn't long before Michael started working the birthday parties with Richards for some extra cash. And this is when Richards began grooming Michael. Within a few months, the molestation began. After the birthday parties, he would be taken to a hotel to be photographed. And at first, you know, with his clothes on, then without his shirt, then down to his underwear. And before you knew it, he was naked and sexual acts were being also photographed by Richards that he performed on this young boy. Michael would soon be one of the boys that was also taken to Fox Island.
So I'm not sure if I missed it or if we're going to get to it. So all the boys that ended up going to Fox Island, they were all groomed in some way before they were taken there? Or were some of the boys that went to Fox Island, like, you know, unbeknownst to them, were they going to start getting traumatized?
Exactly. From what I read, the only one that I have read about being groomed was Michael Farquhar. The other boys had no idea what was going on. They were under the rule that they're going on this amazing summer vacation on a beautiful island where they could, you know, run and frolic and play and be boys. But that's not what happened when they got there. It was a whole different story.
Well, they groomed Michael, and I'm assuming there was probably a couple of other boys sprinkled in there because they use those. Like, what we know is they groom one or two kids, so those two kids or kid will groom 10 more. It's like some kind of sick, twisted pyramid scheme. It's gross. Okay,
and
keep going.
Yep, and that is, and we're going to take it a step back. That's exactly what was happening in the cast corridor. Is the boys on the street were grooming other boys. Hey, this is an opportunity. We're, you know, they're poor. They don't have anything. We get to party. They give us alcohol. They give us drugs. And they pay us. You just have to do a little bit of A, B, and C.
Yeah.
Yeah. So definitely sure you're right on that. So the boys on the island never said anything to their parents about what was happening there, which I just
it's
struggle.
Crazy, but honest to me, like, they probably were threatened if they did. You know,
right,
which would make sense,
right? Or they're embarrassed, or like, how do you say that to your parents? I mean, that goes on now with young girls or boys that are being molested today. They don't want to talk to their parents about it, and when they finally gain the courage to do so, their parents don't believe them.
Which is even worse. But unfortunately, I mean, you know, sometimes kids make up things, and sometimes they're in bad enough situations. Like, if these boys were poorer children, then their parents were, if they weren't screw-ups themselves, their parents were busting their ass, you know what I mean? Like, really trying to make things work, and probably didn't have a lot of time or story or, you know, anything like that. And then we got to remember, this is back in the 70s where, I don't know, kids didn't have a voice. I mean, women barely had a voice back in the 70s. So kids, you know, everything a kid said wasn't believed. So anyway, but there was at least one kid that told his parents.
So I'm actually getting to that. So there was an 8-year-old boy, 8 years old, that was taken to the island, and he was the only one. He was the only one that told his parents, and he ended up telling them because they hurt him really bad. I mean, he was just an 8-year-old boy. He was sexually molested.
Yeah.
So thankfully he did, and this led to the arrest of Gerald Richards. Thank God. So Gerald had to give information at his hearing as part of his deal to give up a client list, as well as the man who owned the island, which was Francis Sheldon. Well, Francis caught wind of that. He was tipped off, and, you know, he packed up everything. This guy lived in Ann Arbor. He packed up everything in his mansion and flew off to Amsterdam. And luckily, thankfully, thank God, North Fox Island was closed for business.
Yeah, small favors.
Yeah, but here's the worst. Here's the worst part of that is just a few months after the island was shut down, that's when the Oakland County killings resumed, starting with Jill, then Christine, and lastly Tim. So Mark Stebbins was first, and then you got all this, you know, pedophile ring going on, the boys being taken to the island, and the killings kind of mellowed out because all these sick bastards were going to the island, having their way in the safety of being on an island. So once
I had a question. I just thought of something, and I don't know why. Maybe sort of thinking about sick and twisted things anyway, so my brain's going all crazy places. But I had a question about Jill and Christine. Do you have any pictures of them?
Yes. So in the show notes,
did they look like little boys when they were all bundled up in their winter gear? Did they take them erroneously, thinking that they were little boys?
That's a great thought process. But the pictures that, you know, the pictures that are in the show notes, like in the links, like, they're school pictures, right? So the one girl kind of had brown hair that was a little long. Both of the girls did. So, you know, who knows? You could be absolutely right. Maybe they thought it was a little boy.
Little boys rocked like Bob.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They rocked shoulder length hair on the regular.
Yeah, they did. And who knows? They're probably wearing their winter coats with their big winter hats. So, you know, who knows? Christine, that's why I love talking to you. I'm telling you.
Well, that just came to me, like, all of a sudden. You know what I mean? Because when an adult, right, and of course, whenever you're trying to see a different perspective, unfortunately, I'm about to say this because that's what you kind of do when you're having these conversations, you put yourself in that psychopath's shoes. And if I'm the psychopath and I'm just trying to get a kid, right, because I want to do all my psychopath things to the kid, I'm going to talk to the kid if the kid talks back to me. And all children at the ages of these children are going to have an agender voice. Do you know what I mean? They're not going to really be gendered at that time because their voices didn't drop if they're little boys. And most little girls, when they're hitting puberty, they actually crack a little bit too. You know, they go from sounding sweet and innocent little babies to, you know, on their way to being women, you know?
Right.
So their voices are all kind of the same at this age.
Agreed. They all sound the same.
Yeah. If I'm talking to a little kid that's out on the street by themselves, I'm going to assume that that's a little boy out on their own by themselves, because little girls do tend to travel in packs. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm just going off of what I know, having one of my own. They travel in packs and they're a little bit too prissy to ride their bike in the snow to the corner, or to walk in the snow to the corner, or whatever the case was. Do you know what I mean? It's just more likely that they might have thought these were little boys, which is why they also didn't keep them as many days either. Correct?
Right.
Am I wrong?
Well, the one little girl was actually kept for 19 days. She was the longest held in captivity. And I don't know why that was, you know, because the others just seemed to be, you know, a handful of days and then they were found in the snow. So why this little girl was held so long, I don't know. And I didn't see any information about that.
The little girl that got shot with the shotgun was the held longest?
No. She was only gone for a few days. Yeah. It was the youngest girl, Christine. She was gone for 19 days, the youngest one. So I don't know what that was about.
Yeah. I don't know either.
Yeah. But
And it kind of gives me the willies just knowing that my brain can put myself in shoes of a psychopath and think what they might have been thinking. That in and of itself is a little bit of a mind screw, you know what I mean?
It is, but here's the thing, that's what we do as nurses, is it not? Like, we try to understand and figure out the psyche of how and why, what would make someone do A, B, C, and D, and E, because our brains don't go there. Like, we, you and I, most people, are not programmed to do these kind of horrific things. It's a taboo. You don't go there. So yeah, I know. I feel the same way.
So did we get a whole clients list from Gerald?
There was
He gave up the client list. Did we get a whole client list for all of the psychopaths that used to go to the island?
He gave up quite a few names. I don't have all of those, but he did give up quite a few people, and especially some of the heavy players, you know, in the game. You're going to like this next, but this is twist of fate. So in the documentary of Children in the Snow, there was a man named Patrick Coffey, who was a childhood friend of Timothy King. And as adult, he became a polygrapher, right? So in 2006, he attended a conference in Las Vegas. He ended up speaking with another Michigander, go figure, who said he gave a polygraph to a man regarding a molestation of a little girl that was not related to the Oakland County child killings. During that particular polygraph, he was getting resistance from the man that he was testing, and, you know, resistance with him getting to answer a certain question. And finally, the polygrapher was so frustrated, he said to the man, quote,
"Why can't you just say no to the question?"
Well, the man said, quote,
"Because I didn't do this one, but I got the King Boy in Birmingham."
The polygrapher immediately realized what he had just said to Coffey, and he would not give the name of the man he was testing, but he would give two clues. One, the man is now dead. And two, so is his attorney. Coffey immediately passed this information to siblings of Timothy King. And once they had this information, they contacted Detective Williams, but requested that the information not be given to the state police. A couple of names resurfaced. So A, here's Christopher Bush, and again, Gregory Green. Remember the last time Bush was arrested, he was released on bond posted by his family. Just 1 week later, Timothy King went missing. Bush's name was also seen on the list of sponsors for North Island. Right?
Yeah.
So a couple of other big names that were thrown out with all of this. I'm only going to just mention their names. I'm not going to go into them. But one was Vincent Gunnels, Arch Edward, and Theodore Lamborghini, and Richard Lawson. For me, my gut tells me that it was Christopher that abducted, tortured, and killed Timothy King. I don't know who did the other children. The others may have certainly had a hand in the abduction, and murders of these children, but these men are either now deceased or in prison, and the ones that are in prison are not talking. And that...
the story of the Oakland County child killer, which I'm still not convinced was just one. However, if it was just the one, it was Christopher Bush. Now we got to go into, not that I ever hope that there is an investigation and they open up a cold case on that, but whoever murdered him, I love that they call it suicide because it won't be a cold case. So that's nice. But can we just end this conversation with the celebration of the fact that he was most likely murdered and then tucked into bed the way they most likely found him? So I'm going to make this story up in my head on the fly because I could totally imagine I was that mother of Timothy. And Timothy's friend came to me and told me that they polygraphed somebody that said I did the King Boy in Birmingham. And they told me where he was. I would be that mother that would drag that MFer out of his bed, go torture him somewhere, then throw him back in his bed after I shot his brains out. I would drag him up the stairs in a, I don't know, what are those things called again? A tarp? I would drag him up in a tarp, get him into his bed, because being an ICU nurse, we could roll those bodies pretty easy. We
yes.
gotta stop, you know, things from happening. So I know I would be able to get this guy back into his bed and tuck him in, make him all nice and clean, probably even clean his fingers and toes, and then put that shotgun right in his hands.
Oh, me too. I'm right. And I would help you.
Call it a suicide.
I would help you.
A neat tucking.
Yes. And I got to tell you, I my heart goes out to any parent who's ever lost a child by the hands of another. Because I personally, I would take out my own vengeance. No one could ever stop me. I'm with you. We'd do it. We'd
I would totally it. Be Mrs. King. Yay, Mrs. King.
We're going to assume it was her.
And I'm glad that you started our little podcast off with this story so I could flip it into a happy ending.
Me too.
Because I'm way too much of a pissy-eyed fool when it comes to kids. That's why I never did pediatrics.
Yeah.
I can't take it. My heart is like, it just breaks for the kids. It breaks for the parents in every situation. And then you start off this freaking podcast with a horrific story about children.
I did.
But
I threw in a doozy.
I'm going to end it with a beautiful story in my mind's eye, be it totally fictitious. I am making it up, choosing to believe it, that Mrs. King got the news from coffee and she went and did a damn thing.
That's how we're ending the story. Mrs.
Yay,
King
Mrs.
got her revenge.
King. That's what we should call this episode. Yay, Mrs. King.
Yay, Mrs. King. So, you know what, Christine, I think this was a great first episode, and I'm so excited to have more of these conversations as we share these stories with you and with anybody out there who wants to listen to us. So thank you, everyone, for listening. Come back next Monday on Malice in the Mitten for more of Christine and Tracy. See you soon.
See you soon. Thanks, everybody. Let us know what you thought.
Let us know what you think.
Bye.
Bye.